You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 131. I know this will be the thing that will be my legacy. They won't say anything about my movies. I'll just be this guy in a rubber mask. Nick Castle.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide screenwriters with professional services to get their films or series packaged, funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, and consulting. If you're looking to package a screenplay or project, Filmmaker Process can help. Head over to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we have a special guest. We have film director, writer, and sometimes horror icon, Nick Castle. Now, Nick is responsible for writing classics like Escape from New York, The Boy Who Could Fly, Tap, Steven Spielberg's Hook, and August Rush. And he is the director of one of the most groundbreaking and my favorite sci-fi films of the 80s, The Last Starfighter. Now, the other thing he's known for is being The Shape. Now, The Shape was the name they gave a character in the movie Halloween by the name of Michael Myers. He is the original Michael Myers in the Halloween franchise. And the story behind how he became Michael Myers was, it's kind of ridiculous how he was able to do it. He was essentially, well, you know what? I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to listen to the conversation to find out. But it is a hell of a story. And Nick really just goes deep down the rabbit hole about all his experiences working with John Carpenter, how he was able to work on Escape from New York, and then later working with James V. Hart, friend of the show, on Hook and August Rush, directing and writing an amazing film called Tap, as well with the legendary Gregory Hines, and so, so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Nick Castle. I'd like to welcome to the show Nick Castle. How are you doing, Nick?
Very good, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm a big fan. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that you've done in your career that I've shaped my life, sir. So I appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I assume you have some questions for me today.
A couple. Okay. So I always like to ask this of all my guests: how did you get started in the business?
Well, I grew up in a family that was in show business. My father was a choreographer. I had an uncle that lived with me who was a lighting designer, and before that, a trumpet player in an orchestra, you know, kind of a swing orchestra. But mainly my dad, you know, he worked with some of the, you know, very important musical comedy entertainers of the 30s, 40s, 50s. Mm-hmm. Judy Garland, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire. He put me in a couple of movies, as a matter of fact, when I was a little kid. Nice. So I kind of had it a little bit in my blood. You know, he would have party. He did a show in the 60s, you know, one of these variety shows, the Andy Williams variety show.
Nice.
And he had the Nick Castle dancers. And I would go on my summer breaks and work with him. Work meaning getting coffee for the dancers. But mainly meeting, you know, you hang around and you meet all these movie stars coming in and out, what, you know, week after week. You'd throw parties at the house, you know. So it's kind of like, you know, I was bound to do something, you know. And I always liked the idea of what the director did. Mm-hmm. And I gravitated to that just by osmosis, kind of. And then wound up going to University of Southern California Film School. And, you know, kind of, you know, tripped into that, not knowing what I was going to get involved with. Had no ambition at that time. This is during the period of late 60s, you know. So I was pretty much a hippie, you know, thinking.
You don't know. Peace and love and flower power. Got it.
That's it. Peace, love, flower power. And hopefully meet a girl. You know, at one
point. Well, obviously, if you're.
And that, and that motivated me to be a big time film director. So,
you know, you're not the first time I've had a director come on. I'm like, I got into film because I wanted to get chicks. I mean, seriously, this is the reason why, you know, obviously. Now, I know that when you were at USC, you met another budding young filmmaker by the name of Mr. John Carpenter. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. John and I met at film school. Oh, it must have been 1967, 68. We worked together on a short film. He was the editor. I was the cameraman. And we both wrote the song and sang at the song of a picture called The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, which was a short that the producer wound up blowing up to 35, entering it as an Academy consideration, and we won the Academy Award.
You guys, I didn't know you guys won the Academy. Really?
It was a four-person crew. Jim Relkos was the director. We all wrote it, and John Longenecker was the producer, and he wound up on the stage getting the gold trophy from Sally Kellerman. It was just pretty hilarious, you know, to start off your career. We weren't even starting a career. We were just in film school and just out of film school by that time. And then we had a cameo. It was all downhill from there.
It was like, and a steady decline. A slow, steady decline for the entire rest of my career. And then you worked in the camera department in Dark Star?
Actually, I worked as kind of anything you need, you know, /actor/gopher/, you know, it was like a film. This was turned out to be a feature film, but it started out as a 40-minute short out of USC.
Oh, okay.
Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien, was the co-creator of the project with John. And, you know, they just needed some buddies to, you know, really needed some hands in there. They had a cameraman, a sound man, them, couple actors, and me, and maybe whoever they could drag off the street, you know, or across the campus to help them do something. So my claim to fame there, though, is it was the introduction of me behind plastic being a character, which was there was a beach ball monster, at least that's what we called it. It was painted to look like a giant tomato. And so I was supple back then, could get behind the thing and kind of do this to make it seem like it's breathing. So if you see that, that's my first foray into acting, as it turned out to be, you know, a very limited part of my repertoire.
Absolutely. Now you also worked with John on another little independent film called Halloween, and that was at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of the most successful independent films of all time. When it came out, I mean, it was an absolute blockbuster runaway hit. And you also played a part in that, which I honestly did not know until I researched this. I was like, oh my God, Nick played The Shape. So can you talk about, first of all, how did you become The Shape? or Michael Myers. And then how did and I've heard so many stories over the years about how that whole movie got put together. You were kind of there, so can you shine a little light about that?
Sure. You know, John, I think, did after Dark Story, his first independent motion picture after that was Assault on Precinct 13. Mm-hmm. And he met some people after that movie. That got a little bit of attention. It was a good movie. It didn't have a big release, but it attracted some people, including Erwin Yablons, who had an idea for a babysitter murder movie, and brought it to John's attention, and John took it over, and off they went. You know, I think he said he wrote it in like a week or a weekend with Deborah, who at that point, Deborah Hill was a producer on the picture, and also his love interest in real life. And so John was, you know, going to shoot it, a part of it, you know, at least pretty close to both where we both lived. We both lived in Laurel Canyon, not very far away from each other, actually. And one of the locations was down in the flats in Hollywood, and I knew it was going to be close by. So I went over there. I said, John, I'm going to come by this set. They were setting up for the next week's shoot. And I said, you know, would you mind if I just hung around? Because, you know, I want to become a director. I'll see what you do. I'll look at all your mistakes and make sure I don't do them. And he went, okay, well, as long as you're going to be here, why don't you put on the mask? Wait a minute. Hold on.
Oh, no, you're not. Stop it.
I'm not going to put on the mask.
Oh, but is that the original mask?
This is the original mask from the 2018 Halloween that I had a little cameo. The original mask I actually kept for a while, and then Deborah actually wanted it to so they could make the new copy for the Halloween 2. But I never got it back, so that is gone.
But that is a William Shatner mask painted white, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. The production designer, who is also close friends with John, in fact, we're hometown buddies from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He literally went to find a man. Yeah, they had no money to sculpt something or anything. They have no money at all. So I think they had about $300,000 to do the whole picture. Mm-hmm. So their, you know, production design budget was minimal. So he went into a local Hollywood, you know, toy store and looking for something that he could make into something. And he found, I think, a clown mask that he thought was interesting. And he saw the Shatner mask. He said, oh, okay, I could do something with that. So he's really the genius when it comes to, you know, because there's so many things that went right with that movie and had to go right to make it so successful. And that's one of them, I think, is really the idea of that mask and the character, of course. But it's spooky. Something's very spooky he wound up getting out of it.
I mean, he was the first. Michael Myers was the first kind of, as we kind of know it, the 80s horror icons, like Freddy and Jason. Mike was the first one, and that really kind of like kind face painted white. I mean, Shatner, you know, this is like a Star Trek mask from the 60s basically, and it's a kind face. It's not like he doesn't have hard features. So that mixed with the hair, and then just it's just weird. It was just it hits you in almost like a primal way when you see Michael Myers, and then of course the music.
Oh my God! Well, John really hit it out of the park there. That again didn't take him very long, but he had an idea of, you know, the kind of timing he wanted, the simplicity, and he's a good musician. You know, self-taught. Even though his dad was a music teacher, you know, but he's not someone that reads music, for instance. Mm-hmm. But he hears it and he can play it. But and then also, you know, a couple of things that he kind of, you know, was in the forefront of, which was that electronic music. Mm-hmm. And then using the, the Panaglide, that spooky kind of airy, that was the first time that was ever used. Oh, I mean, not the first time, but one of the first times in motion pictures.
The Panaglide was kind of like the Steadicam of its day, or was it like a little bit after or before, or a competitor of Steadicam?
I think Panaglide was just the one where Panavision's version of it.
Got it. Yeah. But it was, you're right, it was kind of like this swooping, you know, because the first time you see that, even when you see it in The Shining, I think the first time they used it was on Rocky, wasn't it, in 76, when up the stairs.
Yeah.
It's one of the first. Yeah.
But also using it as a point of view.
That was the first time it was done, right. Yeah. And it was just very, like, you're there. And yeah. I think that is what makes that film so damn spooky. You, behind the mask, you feel like you're the killer. Oh, it's very even today, it still works. It does. It ages very well. Other than the clothes.
Yeah, I think so too. It's, you know, John is a filmmaker. You know, he's just not a shooter. He understands the history of motion pictures, and then, you know, is a student of film, and so, you know, that's brought to bear there, and you can see his raw, not just his raw talent, but his, you know, educated talent, you know, there. I think it's quite well done.
And then you played Michael the entire time?
Yeah, there were certain times when Tommy Wallace, who I mentioned, put on the mask, because this is how cheap it was. You know, they had it. There are a couple of times when, like, Michael puts his fist through a door, or he puts his fist through a closet door, and Tommy just said, "Well, I better do that because I know where I scored the door. So if you miss it and ruin the shot, there's no second door." I don't care about your hand.
That's not. It's really just about the door, honestly.
It's about the door. It's cost $120. They don't have $120. Second door. So that was the reason for that. Then there were a couple other things, like there were stuntmen, and then there was a reveal at the end that wasn't me. They take off the mask, and it's a guy named Tony Moran. They just wanted a certain look for who Michael really looked like. Right. And they had little kids, so I didn't look anything like that little kid. So,
and you were essentially just like hanging around the set, and John's like, "Hey, put the mask on."
Yeah. You'll see some behind the scenes things. I'm just hanging around. I have the mask dangling out of my hand. No one knew, of course, this would be what it became.
Right.
You know, at the time, no one had an inkling. You know, and here I am, like, whatever it is, 40 something years later. That's what I'm known for. I could do Last Starfighter, Tap. I could do all these other movies. Forget it. That has nothing to do with
Michael,
my family.
You're Michael Myers. You're Michael Myers.
Michael damn Myers. You know, so it is pretty fun. I mean, look, I have, you know, I'm an action figure. You know,
you are. Look, I mean, you're exactly. It must be, honestly, it must be so trippy to be in an independent film. And then you're still talking about it 40 odd years later. And I'm sure you're asked about it everywhere you go. And you see, like, that little action figure, and I'm sure you've gone to conventions and events and all of those things. That must be so trippy. Like, you were just like, "I was just hanging around the set. Like, this means nothing. Like, we were just chilling. We had no idea."
I know. I mean, I've actually brought, we've had trips like going to Germany, going to London. And, you know, it becomes a time when I can take my whole family and my kids and their kids, and they have so much fun with it, and it's paid for, you know. So it's pretty hilarious. You know, I don't deserve it in some level to be so lucky, but I take full advantage of it.
As you should, because I'm sure the mask was very uncomfortable. It was hot. It was, I'm sure, you know,
right.
You have to get paid something.
And of course, David Gordon Green, who was the director on the new one, he called me, before they started. He said, "Do you want to do it again?" And I went, "Well, you know, I'm 70 years old now. You know, you don't want some old guy, even though he's supposed to be old, even though it is me."
Michael Myers is technically old.
Yeah, this is supposedly 40 years later. But they got someone that could really actually benefit from his physicality, James Jude Courtney, who, wonderful guy, and it brought a lot to the role. But I got to do these cameos, so it was fun. You know,
you pop in every once in a while,
and I was honored on the set. You know, by the crew, they would have to bow down to me because I am the original.
That's amazing. So, I mean, that's so trippy. That's just so amazing. Now, after Halloween, you jumped in with John again on another classic film called Escape from New York, and you wrote that with him. How did you guys come up with Escape from New York?
Well, you know, John, first of all, John, right out of film school, wrote the first draft of Escape from New York on his own, of course. And he wrote it and stuff like that. And then now what do I do with it? Well, he put it in the trunk, you know, closed the trunk and went off to do other movies. And then after he did, I think, The Fog, the studio that did that, they really wanted to get in business with him. They say, what else do you got? So he went to the trunk, pulled out this, kind of pitched them the general idea without, you know, saying that they had the script complete. And they loved it, you know. So then he called me. He said, Nick, I'm, you know, I really need another set of eyes and ears on this one. Would you be willing to come up and, you know, talk? You know, we'll just come up, have fun, sit around his pool. Again, he lived right next to me. And we'll talk about, you know, flesh this thing out, put some a little bit of humor in it. And, you know, I think he knew what I could bring to it probably. So that's what we did. You know, we just had fun, two friends laughing it up, trying to think of where Snake should go in New York. You know, well, you got to have a taxi ride. You have to go to Madison Square Garden. You got to do this. You got to do that. And then, you know, forming it, coming up with some nihilistic ending, which was pretty hilarious. And then again, that was before I started directing again. So I said, hey, I'm going to hang out again. So I didn't get to play a character. I did play a character in there, actually. When Snake goes into the theater, mm-hmm. and there's a crazy show going on, I'm the piano player playing the song that I wind up writing. I wrote for the movie. So a lot of fun. And, you know, John was so gracious in the midst of all this stuff because it was, you know, it's nice to be able to hang out, you know, throw a few suggestions in. He's very collaborative that way. Great guy. And you know, I learned quite a bit from that kind of apprenticeship.
And you shot on, you guys shot, because obviously you didn't take over Manhattan. So I think you shot in, was it Detroit or Michigan? Where was it?
St. Louis.
Oh, St. Louis.
And those were the locations that I didn't go to. They were shooting, when they got back to LA, I started looking at that. Then they went for a couple of days, which I went to Liberty Island, where they did the Statue of Liberty.
Very cool. That must have been. Was that a studio project or an independent project?
That was studio. AFCO Embassy, I think.
Yeah. Can you imagine a studio making Escape from New York today?
Yes, because they're always talking about reviving it.
No, but like as an original IP.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
I think isn't Robert Rodriguez doing the remake or someone else? I heard there is a remake in the works. Last time I heard, I think it was Robert Rodriguez, and he had John's blessing. And I think John's involved somehow.
Well, John's involved like this. Where's my money? No, John.
Do you want to do it?
Let me think. Yes, where's my money?
Can I have a check? Sure. Absolutely. Give me an executive producer credit. Let's rock and roll. Now, one of your films you've directed impacted me so much when I was growing up, which is The Last Starfighter. And it is just one of those classic 80s films. I mean, in the pantheon of 80s, I mean, I think it was right smack in the middle. It was like 85, 86, if I'm not mistaken. 84. Yeah, so it was around there, 84, 85, 86. So it was right smack in the middle of the 80s. It's full 80s everything. It's just wonderfully done. The story, the thing that was so wonderful about that story is that I was in fourth or fifth grade at that time. I probably saw it a little bit later on VHS when it came out. But that you are the kid. Because he's just playing a video game. And they're like, wait a minute, I play video games. Wait a minute, this could possibly happen to me. And that was the brilliance of that story. Can you tell me how The Last Starfighter came to be, how you became a part of it, all of that?
Well, it was the script was written by Jonathan Betchewell. Remains a very close friend of mine, great guy, again. Talking about being in the trenches, you know, because when I read the script, I had done my first film, Tag the Assassination Game, with a little independent picture, and Lorimar saw it and liked the way it looked and thought, you know, young director getting involved with this would be a good match, probably cheaper too.
Obviously.
Yeah, than getting an old veteran. And so I read the script. I thought it needed quite a bit of work, but like you say, the brilliance of the storyline is just, you can't, it kind of like, it's so simple and so obvious, especially for that era, you know.
Oh, God, video cards.
Yeah. And John, I know, came up with the idea with it. And he's a New Yorker. He went into a video game parlor, whatever you call those things, and saw people doing this. And then he was reading, I think, some version of Sword and Stone, you know, the King Arthur myth. You know, that there is something, someone that's born for to be the leader. And he thought, whoa, that's, you know, just clink, came up with. He's like that, too. Boy, talk about a guy with, you know, where you, which is the most difficult thing, is that coming up with the creative nugget, the idea that everything circles around, that you build on. But he's wonderful like that, and very funny, too. I think it brought a lot of humor to it. So that's only to say that we spent, I think, almost a year, maybe 8-9 months, on the next draft of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And so we were in a room together, you know, just making the thing work, waiting for them to decide to finally green light it. And in the meantime, they had engaged a new kind of technology for this called digital technology. No one had ever heard of it. Yeah, someone said they did something in Tron, but you know, that looked like, you know, it was
because even Star Wars wasn't digital, it was analog.
Oh, no,
that was all analog.
It was, yeah, and those were all models and stuff like that. So this was starting, this had no physical element, you know, so we were in a way stuck because of the good price that Digital Productions gave for their to do all the visual effects with them, and kind of scarily, you know, they were doing research and development as we were doing the screenplay. So a lot of balls in the air, and a lot of things that were kind of difficult and crazy. So, you know, again, another person in my life that I thought was, we'll always have Starfighter together. And then we had a good time. The shoot was pretty easy. The post-production took another year. That was tough.
For people listening, you guys have to understand that the visual effects are in The Last Starfighter is so kind, it's a little bit ahead of its time, and you guys were basically in the bleeding edge of technology, emphasis on bleeding. because I was looking at it, and I was just like, I just recently went back and watched it. I was just like, this is, I mean, I'm a VFX guy. I mean, I've been VFX souping, and I understand how things are done. I'm like, the computer power back then, you're talking 83, 84, and 82, 83. In that world, my God, like, they were still using giant floppy, like it wasn't like you could just get things off the shelf. So it's amazing. And how did you as a director even did you shot elements, didn't you? You shot like plates and things for people to comp in and stuff, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we had the entire picture was storyboarded. I storyboarded even, you know, all the just live action material that they didn't even have visual effects accompanying it, but we had some excellent people on the picture that two of which are still, well, one of which is still a very close friend, who's the art director was Jim Bissell. Mm-hmm. Jim did he just does everything.
He's done okay.
He's done okay. So you have that going for you. Then we had the master, Ron Cobb, who, if you don't know Ron, he was a production designer. He just passed away, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But he was one of my best friends, and he might as well have been a second director, because he was such a good artist. He could, you know, he came up with all the character art, all the hardware art, wow, all the symbols. everything. You know, he just is a master at design. And he was the one that could tell me what I could expect out of, you know, what digital productions would be able to do. And, you know, here's the upside, here's the downside, here's what we should do. And it's why the interior, for instance, of the ship is so simple. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have liked it to be, Ron was cautioning and going, you know what, I don't know if they're going to be able to get that kind of complexity into this. So let's go as simple as possible. So those kind of things were used, that information was important to kind of figure out what we were up against.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So great team. Gary Allison was a producer, was the son of the owner of the company. So that helped.
So made sure you had everything you needed.
Yeah. Gary's strength. He was also very, very good, very good at story too, and has a lot of good ideas. And that was a good team, real good team. And like you say, it's a staple of the 80s. It's something that is always threatening to be either remade or made a sequel.
I've heard rumors for years about it. So do you have any updates on that? Anything going on?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, back in the early 2000s, John and I had a script with a studio, and it was really very close to getting started, but it just fell apart because of these complicated rights issues, because it turned out to be that two studios had claimed to the rights, and neither of them would get into partnership with each other. And John had the rights to the characters. And then finally, within the last few years, Jonathan got the rights back because of the age of the project, I think. And now he has another way he thinks he wants to approach it. So there may be some
hope
for all the Starfighter fans. There may be in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
a new version. And what he has always wanted to do is, no matter how long in between, make it a sequel. So it's not like a reimagining. It's not like,
yeah,
you know, and this was something we wanted to do, almost 20 years ago now, when we wrote it, kind of prefiguring what Star Wars wound up doing their 40 years later thing.
Right.
So I thought we were pretty clever. We came first, even though
didn't get produced.
We had it first. Wherever you are, billions of dollars.
Counting, just count. I picture him in a Scrooge McDuck situation with the gold nuggets. No, they did it with Tron, which is very similar. Like they did that sequel, and I think that was, you know, I loved about the sequel, about this, like they just, you know, brought in the old and brought in the new, and I think that would be an amazing thing to be able to do with The Last Starfighter, like with today's video games and, you know, virtual reality, there's so many different angles you can go after with it. I wanted to ask you though, as a director during that time, being on the bleeding edge of technology, I've had the experience of being on a project where I didn't know if the visual effects were going to come through, and the story depended on certain level. Like if we can't make this VFX work, the movie doesn't work. Right. And that is and at the time that I was doing it, it was just like really at the beginnings of off the shelf visual effects. Meaning like my team that I had, you know, we had the tech, but like no one had really done it on this level on an indie short film. And it was like really high end stuff. And my guys were all kind of young, which, by the way, they all went off to do like Star Wars and Skyfall. And these guys all turned out to be amazing visual effects artists. But at the time I was terrified. So I did kind of had a backup plan just in case I could maybe cut that out or cut around it. But did you at some point, did you just go, man, if this doesn't work, we don't have a movie?
Well, yeah, no, that was always in the back of our – it wasn't just me. Can you imagine the studio?
Right.
That put the 13 or 14, whatever it was, $1 million into the thing that up, you know, At one point, our visual effects coordinator, Jeff Okun, who did a fantastic job too, by the way, saving our ass a number of times, he did the calculations and he's, you know, at this rate, this will be done in 5 years. You know, this, they can't sustain it, you know, because every frame,
no,
you know, so long to render, you know, every frame. And you know, even though they had what they called the Cray computer, yeah, which was a thing that looked like a giant sofa. In fact, it did have something you could sit on, and then all these kind of, it looked very, very, very 80s visual effects. It looked
beautiful.
And even though they had that, it really did have the, you know, the amount of power that's now in my,
Apple Watch. Yeah.
Yeah. It really, and I'm serious.
I know.
Yeah. And so your point is, yeah, everyone was nervous about it. And we just had to be creative, you know, things like, that's why I had to be there for a year in post-production. I'd be on the, in post-production at a terminal looking at the thing, and they would go, okay, that plane back there, is it going to get any closer than this? Because if it doesn't, we don't have to put all this other, you know, information onto it. We can just let it be kind of like a stick figure. And I said, no, you're good with the stick figures. But every shot, every element, stuff like that, we had to do in order to make it make sense. And then there were things that are the worst. The worst of the effects were their inability to do terrain. Like there's a sequence where the ships are going to tunnels.
Forget it.
And, you know, they could not at that point get the detail and then smooth out the edges and things like that that needed to make it look. And Jeff, he had a whole plan of doing models for that and came to the production and said, okay, we'll fly the digital ship, but we'll do it in models and it'll look real as opposed to this. And the production said, how much is that going to cost? And he told them, they said, no, we have this much money. Those guys said they could do it. They're going to do it. So I wound up in the final coloring, you know, just at some point, I just kept going lower, bring down the color, the lighting. So you could see some of those shots. You can't even see where you're looking. And it's for good reason. It looks so bad.
That's amazing. So you just kept darkening. It's like, oh. So for everybody listening out there, visual effects are bad. Just darken it. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. Listen, when I was in film school, it was 95, and I was working on a video toaster back in the day.
Right.
And I remember a ship just doing a 3D model of a spaceship and moving it from point A to point B. That was 5 days.
Yeah.
And if it crashed, you start again. So I could only imagine what you guys had to go through. Oh, it's insane.
And things weren't invented. For instance, motion blur, which for your audience is like,
right,
you know, car goes by and you know, you kind of see it in a swish of colors and stuff like that. Well, if a ship went like that against your camera, it would pixelate. Because you have to instruct it to have this blur. So they had to invent motion blur for the movie. And they didn't know how to do that. You know, yes. Just things that are kind of simple physics in models are not simple physics in the digital world. So, you know, there's a lot of very inventive people. Talk about people in that world that went on to do work, you know, that they all are, you know, master technicians.
Jesus, you know? It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Now, when you also got involved with a friend of the show, Mr. James V. Hart, who's been on the show a few times, and you worked on another one of my favorite films growing up, which is Hook. And you work with Jim on Hook. And I've heard the story from his point of view that his son said, hey, what happened if Peter Pan grew up and all that stuff? How did you get involved with Jim on that?
Well, Jim, let's see. I had done a movie for TriStar, and the the people there were fond of the movie, liked working with me. And then the same producer of The Last Starfighter came to me with Jim's idea of exactly what you just said. I'm sure Jim does a wonderful job of it. Giving the background with his son and everything like that. Talk about another. This was very Starfighter-y in a way. What a kernel of an idea that you can build around. You know,
it's so great that you can't believe that no one has ever thought of that. Like, what happened if Peter Pan grew up?
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just such a wonderful notion. So, similarly to what I just explained in The Last Starfighter, first of all, the company said, okay, Nick, we like you. We like the idea. Nick, will you work with Jim on the screenplay and develop it with him? And I went, yeah, because this could be great. So again, this was another one, which I don't know how long we took. Again, another, at least a half a year, maybe more, just going over it, coming up with the structure, some of the details, and you know, Jim went off and wrote it, and we'd get back together and this and that. And we came up with, I thought, a very good first draft, you know, a solid first draft that went out to the movie, the stars that got interested in it. At that point, I was going to direct it. And then the studio got a little cold feet when they saw how big this could be, you know. And so without going into on any of the gruesome details, the picture then eventually got to Steven, and Steven did a very nice job, I think, on it, and brought in some other talent to help Jim with some of Steven's ideas. So and it became what it became. So it's a solid piece, and I was always really fond of that. And because, again, back in the trenches with someone like Jim, we became very close from that.
Now, did you get to hang out on the set?
No, I went on to do some other work, you know, and I had a couple screenplays I wanted to write that never got made. I used my time that by that time I didn't need the apprenticeship.
No, I understand that, but it's still, I mean, it's from what I heard, it was everybody took a visit of that set because it was the most remarkable production set. Like the people were just visiting it just to, like, Jesus, look at this thing. I mean, it was all the talk.
And the other thing that I remembered, I did visit the set, and what was interesting about that is the cameraman from Halloween did Hook, Dean Cundey. So I knew that gang, and he had some of the old gang from Halloween. So I did get to say hi to those guys too, which was a lot of fun.
Very small, small, small business, isn't it?
Small business.
Now, when you write, by the way, do you outline? What is your writing process?
Most of the time, I will whatever notion comes. I have a yellow pad. You know, here's the little version of it. This is the mini version, but usually a big yellow pad, and just start. You know, come idea, 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 idea. First, kind of, you know, pages and pages of ideas that come to me. And then at the point where I go, okay, I get it. I think I know where I'm going. I have a beginning, middle, and end. Then the next page I go just, you know, scene one and start, again, still longhand, right. You know, going through it, coming up with ideas, maybe some dialogue notions, things like that, before I get to the computer at the typewriter.
Right. Now, do you start with the character or the plot? What comes first?
It really depends on the project. What's driving the interest of the project? Sometimes it comes from not even me. Like, for instance, I did a movie called Tap.
Yeah.
About Tap.
Gregory.
Yeah, Gregory. That came from, in fact, the same company, Lorimar, the same owner of the company, the same producer that I worked with on Last Starfighter. Merv Adelson came back from New York once, and I was talking to him, you know, walking down the halls of Lorimar, and he said, Nick, I know your dad was a dancer. He was a tap dancer, right? And yeah, I said, I just came back from watching 42nd Street, or one of those, you know, silly, you know, yay, tap dance movies. And he said, let's do one. Why don't we do one? Why don't you come up with something? So there's a situation where you have a subject, you know, no story, no character, but you're given this kind of a gift, because I just thought, oh my God, what a gift. I always wanted to do musicals coming out of film school, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was a love that I had, you know, from my dad, but also just from my own experience looking at the history of film. I just love Vincent Minnelli, for instance. I just love the classic work there. And there's something thrilling about that work. So I spent the next 6 months or so investigating what was out there, you know, just in terms of talent. And I came very quickly to the idea that there's only one person there, Gregory Hines, that really exemplifies, great, you know, the spirit of the of TAP. That's when I started to come up with a storyline. It's a very weird way to do a movie, and usually, and it shows. I think I'm happy with the movie, but it shows its the weakness is in starting with an idea instead of a
character, you know, or plot.
A character or plot. Yeah, something like like we were talking about before. If you have the idea of what happens if Peter Pan grows up, you know, boom, you know where to go with that. If you
that's
just
character. You're just starting with character, yeah, basically.
Yeah,
go.
Yeah, exactly. Or a situation like, you know, The Last Starfighter, where it's like, you know, what if you were, you know. So it's a little backwards, and it's a tough thing to pull off. I wouldn't suggest it necessarily starting with that. But sometimes you're told, like my first movie called Tag the Assassination Game, same kind of thing. I had not directed then, but my neighbor came up to me and said, Nick, I have some people that want to do this craze, do a movie about this craze that's going on college campuses called Assassination, or I forget what it was called. It was like rubber tip dart guns, then you go around and stuff. Boy, you couldn't do that now.
Not so much nowadays.
But you can see how innocent we were back.
Oh my God, people don't understand. How we're alive is beyond me. I talk to my wife all the time, like, how did we survive our teens, like in our college years? I mean, the things you do to yourself at that age. Oh my God, it's insane.
But there was a situation where, you know, I agreed to put together a little draft of a treatment, you know, based on an idea in a newspaper, as opposed to, you know, so that one kind of helped itself, because it seemed like once I thought, okay, then the game goes for real. Someone goes crazy and starts using a real gun. Okay, now I know what I'm going to do. Boom. So those are the kind of things that... you know, there are different things like The Boy Could Fly, which I did in the 80s as well, came from my friend Ron Cobb, who I mentioned before as a production designer. He was going to do the original E.T. He was directing E.T. It was a horror film before it was what it turned out to be. When Steven saw it and went, I'm going to change this, you know, and I think I'm going to direct it. I'm sensing a kind of deja vu here.
There's a little deja vu there.
But Ron was talking about how the character was going to be maybe autistic, this kid. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know much about that, but I really found that fascinating. And so I thought, I want to think about this like a kid who's autistic that, it almost seems like they're magical. And at the time I was reading Dumbo to my kid, you know, you put the two things together,
I know,
you shuffle around and then boink, the light goes on and then you have a movie, you know?
I think someone has cut online somewhere a trailer as E.T. as a horror movie. Like they've edited a trailer that's a horror movie. And you could easily, from that movie, you could easily cut a horror movie trailer.
Yeah.
But that would have been an interesting approach, to say the least.
Right.
Now, you also worked with Jim on another one of my favorite films, which is August Rush.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved August Rush. And I've had Paul on the show, I've had Jim on the show, and now I have you. So I'm now it's a trifecta. So from your point of view, how did you get involved with that project and mold it into what it was? Because it was kind of a meeting of minds, if you will, taking it to different places.
Well, this was another a project that came to me through the producer. There was a screenplay by Paul, and what it had was a great notion, a great character that this kind of real but surreal sense about it, but again a way to talk about the magic of music in a way, you know, that we all kind of love and it moves us. We don't even understand what that is that moves us. You know, I just loved all that. And the fact of putting it in a character that has somehow embodied it, you know. Paul had it going off to a certain right field, you know, with the basketball and the kid grows up and stuff like that. And when I read it, I came up with an idea, I think, that solved what would create the essence of the storyline, which is the kid lost his parents, and they're both musical people, and he's born without them, and he still needs them, and the way he finds them is through the music. And he doesn't grow up, you know, like it was in the original thing, but he goes on a journey to find them. And in the journey, he finds, it becomes a little bit of, a classic English character, you know, who meets various nefarious and friendly characters on his journey. So it was a journey movie, but based on this kind of instinct that this kid had for being able to hear music in anything. I also, it was a notion I had in Tap too, that there's a scene in that movie where I came up with the idea that the father had got his rhythms from the sounds of the city. So he would hear like a car going over a grating and hear da-dum-ba-dum-ba. So he would take that and go da-dum-da-dum-da, start, you know, but, you know, so that idea that the mind creates a connection with nature. In that case, with the city, so there was something about that I thought was fantastic that was in Paul's original idea to expand that, and so we went from there, and then I wanted to direct it, you know, and
Stephen didn't do this one. I know that he didn't get that one from you, Nick.
He didn't do that one. but the producer wasn't sure. He wanted to keep his idea, his options open. And this is before I did my draft, by the way. So I said, well, I got to direct it or else I'm not going to do it. So I walked away. And about, I don't know, 5 months later, I kept thinking of it and thinking of it and going, God damn, I know how to make this thing work. And it's could be really cute. And so I went back to the producer. I said, okay, have you got it any further? And he said, not really. And I said, let me come on. I'll just write it. And we'll see how it goes. So that's what happened. I just wrote it. And it got to a stage where, it looked like it could be, it could attract some money in a studio. And then Jim came on and just really did a nice job embellishing it, bringing in characters that it needed to, and, really kind of brought it home.
Right. And then the second Robin Williams said, yes, it was a go picture.
That's right. It's always somehow Robin Williams. And, you know, I didn't meet Robin on Hook, and I didn't meet Robin on that either.
Wow.
But I did meet Robin somewhere in between there at my friend's wedding, who was a friend of his. Right. But I never did. And of course, I never will now have had the chance to just kind of sit down and say, God, if only we almost, or I would have loved to had a relationship with him, because he just seemed like such a great guy.
Yeah, Jim talks just, I mean, we have a long conversation about Robin and some hilarious stories of stuff that they went through from being on Hook and on August Rush and stuff. But Robin was, I had a chance to meet him for 10 minutes one day, and you know, it's something that you don't forget. And he wasn't on that day, and he wasn't cracking jokes. He was just normal. And it was actually a few months before he passed, which was really it was really rough. But I had the pleasure of meeting him. It was, and Jim said it when he was on the show. He's like, you know, the script was going around town and this and that. But then Robin Williams said yes, and it was automatically a go picture. Like instantly, they're like, okay, here's X amount of dollars, and let's rock and roll. And he was one of those guys that could just the second he said yes, everybody said yes with him. It's nice. It's nice.
Look at that.
It's nice if you have that kind of power. Now, when you directed that first film, The Tag, The Assassination, what was the biggest lesson you pulled from that? That was the first time you directed a feature.
Yeah, it was. The biggest lesson I learned. It's a lesson going forward. You know, I think it was a lesson and eventually something I look back at and go, oh, was the lesson the correct lesson? I'll tell you. To be prepared. You got a $1 million picture. You have 25 days to shoot it. And you, for a young filmmaker, I wanted to know every angle, making sure I had the right eye line for every shot.
Don't cross that line. Don't cross that line.
Yeah, don't cross the damn line. Have been at every location, have storyboarded everything, at least in my own little scribbles, so that I could approach the production from the standpoint of a professional. You want to go in, you are the leader of the gang, and you want to be able to impart a certain amount of stability to the crew so that they do their best work, you know. So I think that was it. But why I say that that was also problematic is that you could get so stuck in that, in the barriers that you put up for yourself, or, you know, here's what I'm going to do, here's that, you lose a certain amount of spontaneity that you can get from the set. Not that I didn't do that, but I remembered one time on the set, my favorite moment, and it's no one would ever notice it. Hamilton is talking about something. She says something very, something dramatic. And right in back of it was a barbecue. And way in the distance, and I said, "Oh, good. Hey, get some fluid, get some barbecue. And when I do this, you throw the barbecue light in the background." And so she says this thing, and then the fire goes up in the background, just as a kind of hint. That was my favorite part of it because it was so spontaneous.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of fun out of that. And I think that's what a lot of good directors look for. And it took me a while to try, and maybe it's been part of what I look back at and don't like about what I did, is that sometimes it's just too much on the horse holding the reins back, you know. But that's a gift and something you have to watch out for, especially as young people. They want to do it right, you know. And it's scary doing that. So you want to be prepared. You want to have it all together, but you also have to open up to what's available to you too, especially to the actors.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though. I think that you that's time and age and experience. Like, your first move, you've got a first-time director out there who's just like, let's play jazz out here, everybody. Let's just do this or that. Yeah. You're scared to death because the guy has never done it before. The gal hasn't done it before. So I guess those first features have to be a little bit more tight, you know. But then as you get older and you do more stuff, then you just become much more relaxed. And I always equate it to being like catching the magic. You know, catching the thunder or the lightning in a bottle, because there's things that you will never see other than when you're on set. The magic right. that the actor brings, or the environment brings, or something happens, or you just see a barbecue in the background, like, wait a minute, boom, throw something. That's something you can't plan for, you know? Yeah. Now, did you also have, like, because I do this all the time when I go on set, a shot list that's obscene. Like, I hand it over to the first AD, and the first AD is, oh, 80 shots. Okay. Before lunch. Oh, okay. And at those first days, I was so prepared. That's what I would give them. And then obviously I would get four. Now I'll do like 40 and I'll just tell them, I understand. We're not getting all of these. I know we'll get 10, but they're here just in case things are just flowing.
Yeah.
Is that, was that your case as well? Like, did you like overshot list something that people are like, you're insane?
No, you know, I was pretty conservative in that way. You know,
okay.
I kind of could see how long it would take to light, which was, you know, so I'd prepare for that. That would be part of my calculus. And I would have, you know, especially like we're saying for the early shows, you know, I would have the shot list, boom, to my assistant, the assistant to the AD to the cameraman. And we'd pretty much have the day planned. Down to the inserts, you know. So but like you're saying too, as things went on, I would be maybe just get bored with that kind of preparation or get lazy. Yeah. After a while, you know, you get lazy and you just go, okay, I know what I want. I'll just give them a general idea. And they said, we're fine. Don't worry about it. We're fine.
But that takes time, and a lot of first-time directors don't get that, or even young directors don't get them. Like, you know, at a certain point, like I'll just walk on a set now and just go, all right, here. I'm not going to storyboard out a dinner scene, like, unless it's something really elaborate. But before I would.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you need that security blanket. But now you're like, all right, put the camera here. Let's go over here. Let's dolly here. Let's rock and roll. But when you get more elaborate with some of these sequences, yes, storyboarding and previs and all that would help. You've worked with some amazing actors over the course of your career. Do you have any advice on how to direct actors, especially for young filmmakers?
No.
You're screwed, all of you. I'm sorry.
I say that honestly. You know, I'll probably come up with something as we speak. But, you know, we weren't, at least at USC Film School, during the years that I were there, we didn't have any education dealing with actors. It was the one thing that I'm sure they must have corrected.
Nina Foch, the great, yeah, Ms. Foch, she had a legendary class there. That I've taken because it got recorded before she passed, and I took it. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. And everyone from Ed Zwick, and I mean, they all took those classes and they're like, oh my God, it changed the way. Yeah. So they did fix it, but you were screwed basically. Got it. You should actually get a refund for a little bit of the tuition. Yeah, I'm just saying.
Exactly. So, you know, I just would be, sometimes playing it by ear. Cause you know, the actors have different processes. You know, you can't assume that you're going to say, okay, we're going to have a 2-week rehearsal period, and you're going to come in here, and you're going to do this, and you're going to be, it's something that the first thing would be is to have dinner with your actors and get a sense of who they are and just have a rapport that's independent of the story, just to get a feel for how, you know, what their personality is like and what to expect. Of course, you can get a little sense of that from their own histories. Mm-hmm. So, but most of what I did as a director was came out of the general sense of, you know, my understanding of human psychology, which, you know, you don't have to take necessarily a course for that. You just have to be a kind of aware of it. And then, of course, like, I probably are closer to some of the directors that are more about making sure that they have just hired the right person. That and a lot of the people that you get, you can get, are themselves filmmakers. You know, they understand the film process. They understand, you know, everything about it and the difficulties. Some are prima donnas. You're going to have to deal with that, of course. But I've found a lot of the people are, you know, they understand how the process works. You know, where you're going to, you know, and you try to make the sets as comfortable as you can. Right. I think, and that's another thing I think that's so different from director to director to actor to actor. My theory was to make the set itself just a fun place to be. There would be no screaming. There will be no, you know, not even just between me and the actors, but between anybody and anybody else. If you have a problem, let's take talk it back and discuss it. You know, just so you know, you feel like now some people do it the opposite way and they get a lot out of it, the confrontation, you know, and the tension. Maybe it works for certain things.
Yeah, from speaking to you here for this hour, your energy doesn't seem to be that guy. No. The yeller, the screamer, you seem the happy set, the collaborative set, hey, we're here to have some fun set. But I've been on those other sets where they thrive on confrontation. They thrive and it pushes them to another place. But that's someone else's process. And hopefully you signed up for that as an actor with that director. It's not a surprise to you. Now, I'm going to ask you the last few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker starting in the business today?
Well, it's funny because I was just talking to a young filmmaker. It depends on your skill level and what you're looking for. If you're talking about becoming a director, the artist, the person in charge of the film, the thing that was very instrumental to me in the days and weeks leaving film school was, one, to have a film that I had done. You know, now is the best time, I think, in the history of motion pictures for young people to be able to produce, direct, write, edit, and finish something that you can actually see on absolutely no money, assuming you can, you know, you have friends and colleagues and, you know, that'll help you. So that's a big thing that I think was very difficult for us to do back in the day. But the other thing that you have control over is the screenplay. And anybody that's a filmmaker, I think, should be a writer. And some people have different skills, but I think that's something, again, that no one can. It's not a collaborative medium. It's something that you are there, you and the and the typewriter, and the keyboard, and. And you can finish something and have something, a product that shows your talent. And if you have good ideas, I mean, you're not going to, as a filmmaker, you're not going to walk in someplace and say, I want to be a filmmaker. You know, you're going to, either you've done a little short, which is, you know, is a wonderful, a tool, or you have a screenplay, you know, that's both of those things now, are available to you. The other thing now, getting to that point that you have something valuable is the other thing that you need to do, which is learn the history of film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of it out there.
So a couple things, yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much. One of the best things out going to USC Film School, as a matter of fact, I've felt was not just meeting the individuals that I would wind up working with and getting a lot of help from like John, for instance, but it was the film retrospectives. You know, there'd be a Preston Sturges festival, there'd be a Western festival, there'd be people coming over talking about films. All that stuff just goes right into here and it stays there, you know, it stays in there and you start to create your own sense of I want to say ethics, aesthetics.
Style, yes.
Style, aesthetics. And you start to find you know, as an artist. So, the other thing that I remember John Huston saying to that question, I went to on the Queen Mary, the Directors Guild had a weekend of John Huston movies with John Huston.
Oh my God!
Great filmmaker, and someone asked him, what should young people do to get in to become filmmakers? He said, read, read and live, read and live.
You know, absolutely.
It was very simple to him. You have to experience things. You can't just experience. Now we're talking about learn the history of film. You can see yourself sitting in front of your 60-inch TV. Watching the latest, you know, Steven Spielberg from 1975 or something, and think that's filmmaking. Well, that's important. And going back even, obviously, even further is important. But actually, having something you're passionate about only comes from living, reading, and that's something that can be forgotten in the world of a. This can be such a mechanical, a mechanical art, and it's one of the good things about the new technology, by the way, that I think is that you're not necessarily confronted by this giant camera anymore.
No, it's this.
Yeah,
it's this.
Yeah, right. Right, which I always found intimidating. I mean, you had almost no physics to understand what you could really do.
Oh, my God. When you get that first, like, Area 435 up or 535 up or forget it. It was on a Panavision. Jesus Christ. Like, you needed a degree just to turn the damn thing on.
Along with the, the intimidation of being on a set with all the other things you have to do with that giant camera, the one thing that, which we've been talking about, is to be able to sit back and be able to assess it on the bigger picture. You know, literally, that's not a pun, but a bigger picture of how it's playing. That's maybe the most difficult thing to be to understand is to be able to keep keep that story, fresh and in those bits and pieces that you do every day, that continuity that has to be there for it to feel like a real story, a real movie.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh dear. Yeah, I think it is that same thing in a way, stepping back to smell the roses, smell the flowers.
Enjoy the journey.
I'm doing, we're doing it right now. I'm trying to think of how much more I can spend with my family. Now that I'm basically retired, of course, I can't retire in a certain way, but enjoying the latter years of my life becoming, the most involving and enjoying living. So most of the time when we're enjoying making a movie or enjoying our career or enjoying, there's so much about the acts of creating a career, and it's, you have to do it in order to be successful. You have to put everything into it. Mm-hmm. Be able to step outside of it is the most important thing.
And last question, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, boy. Let's say Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah, that's come up quite a bunch.
Has it?
Yes, it has. It has.
It's a beautiful film. God, there's just so many. I would The Searchers.
Oh, also another one that's made the list many times.
And let's see. West Side Story.
Yes, very good. Yeah. Which brings us back to what we talked about earlier, which is now being remade by Steven Spielberg. So,
what?
Another one. Another one.
Another one again. That's funny.
Nick, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. I really appreciate you taking out the time to talk to the tribe today and sharing your knowledge and experience and stories with us. So I truly appreciate it, my friend. Thank you so, so much. And I hope to see you on the set of Last Starfighter 2.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Thank you, Alex. Thanks a lot.
I want to thank Nick so much for coming on the show and sharing his filmmaking journey with the tribe today. Nick, thank you so much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch some of these amazing films, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/485. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.